Today is Monday, April 5th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. What's the impact of the fractures within Jordan's royal family?
Politically, the real danger is opening the door for competition within the throne itself.
Plus, rescue and recovery efforts continued Sunday after Taiwan's worst rail accident in over seven decades. And deadly protests continue in Myanmar as the Pope condemned armed conflict on Easter Sunday. We'll have these stories and more next. Jordan's Deputy Prime Minister, Ayman Safidi, says that King Abdullah's half-brother and former crown prince, Prince Hamza, worked with foreign parties on a plot to destabilize the country. Hamza, an outspoken critic of corruption in Jordan, had called for holding those responsible to account. Analysts say the opposition is not to the government, but to economic, political, and social policies adopted by the king. Dale Gavlak starts us off.
Division in Jordan's ruling royal family erupted into the open late Saturday when Prince Hamza, King Abdullah's younger half-brother, announced he could not leave his home, and state media reported that senior officials had been detained in a security probe. Hamza sent a video recording to the BBC saying he was being silenced and lashed out at authorities, saying the country had become stymied in corruption, nepotism, and misrule. Jordan's military told Hamza to stop activities targeting the country's stability and security. While those actions were not publicly spelled out, Army Chief Yusuf Haneti denied reports that Hamza had been arrested. Jordanian analyst Labib Kamhawi explains what may have led to actions taken against Hamza.
His latest campaign in visiting various tribes, which the king believes the Jordan tribes are the base of his power and the source of all the personnel of the security establishment, the armed forces, the intelligence. So he looked at Hamza's attempt to penetrate these tribes as being a direct threat to his power base. What the king did is to preempt things and simply put an end to Hamza's campaign, and at the same time he gave a clear signal to all the opposition in Jordan that my tolerance has a limit. Even my brother had to pay for opposing me and my policies.
Hamza is the eldest son of American-born Queen Noor and the late King Hussein. After Hussein's death in 1999, Abdullah ascended to the throne and named Hamza as crown prince. 5 years later, Abdullah stripped him of the title. The position would have put Hamza next in line for the throne. Abdullah named his eldest son, Hussein, as crown prince. Jordanian analyst Amr Al-Sabaili says the country's security apparatus, along with the United States and regional powers, all expressed firm support for King Abdullah, but that the incident points to unprecedented public fractures within the royal family.
Politically, the real danger is opening the door for competition within the throne itself. This criticism among the family itself, this has never happened in Jordan. But other than that, I cannot see really any threat that can make me feel concerned.
The coronavirus pandemic has severely impacted the economy of Jordan, a resource-poor nation dependent on foreign aid, which also shelters more than 1.5 million refugees from neighboring conflicts. Kamhawi and other observers say they believe that Abdullah's tolerance of overtures by Hamza and his associates to dissident tribesmen and opposition figures had worn thin. So the king decided to act, signaling, be careful, there should be a limit to what you do. Dale Gavlak for VOA News, Amman.
British police say that 107 people were arrested in London over the weekend during demonstrations against government plans to increase police powers. AP correspondent Zaria Shackley is up next.
Thousands marched in towns and cities across the country on Saturday to protest the police crime sentencing and courts bill, defying coronavirus restrictions. Police said the Kill the Bill protests were mostly peaceful and most of those taking part observed social distancing. They said a small number of people were intent on causing disruptions. They said that those arrested committed alleged offences, including violent disorder, assaulting police officers, and breaches of coronavirus legislation. The police said 10 officers had been injured, though none of the injuries was believed to be serious. Zaria Shackley, London.
Demonstrations against military rule continued in Myanmar Sunday, with many protesters using Easter eggs to aid their movement. Eggs bearing slogans such as Spring Revolution and We Must Win, as well as drawings of a three-fingered salute, were in the hands of thousands of protesters across Myanmar on Sunday in a nod to the Christian holiday. Hundreds of people have been killed in violent crackdowns on protests over the past 2 months after the February 1st military coup. The Assistance Association for Political Prisoners, a nonprofit human rights organization based in Myanmar, has tallied 557 deaths and more than 2,700 arrested since the protests began. Protests on Sunday drew thousands into the streets of Yangon, Mandalay, and other cities. Local news outlets reported that security forces opened fire on a crowd of protesters in the city of Pienmana, killing at least one person. In Naypyidaw, police fired on protesters on motorbikes, killing two men, according to the Irrawaddy news site. Police, as well as a spokesperson for the junta, did not answer telephone calls seeking comment. Pope Francis has used his traditional Easter message to denounce the wars that rage around the globe, even amid a global pandemic. AP correspondent Ben Thomas reports.
The Pope delivered his Urbi et Orbi address inside St. Peter's Basilica so as not to attract crowds to St. Peter's Square, noting the coronavirus continues to spread and with it social and economic crisis. He called it scandalous that wars have not ended and military arsenals continue to be strengthened. He also appealed anew to the international community to overcome delays in distributing COVID-19 vaccines and to ensure supplies reach the poorest countries. I'm Ben Thomas.
Taiwan's transport minister has inspected the site of Friday's train crash as rescue efforts continued after an accident killed 51 people and injured more than 188. The train collided with a truck that slid down an embankment from a nearby construction site. Reuters' Jason Albano takes it from here.
Taiwan's transport minister inspected the site and said he would take responsibility for the accident. On Saturday, loved ones of the victims gathered near the site to mourn. Priest Sung Chi Chang was there as a show of support to the survivors. He told Reuters how one woman woke up after the accident to find that both her husband and son were not breathing and had no heartbeat. She later found her daughter pinned underneath sheets of iron. As she tried to free her, her daughter's voice became quieter and quieter until there was no more response. The accident happened on Friday at the start of a long holiday weekend. It was packed with tourists and residents going home for the traditional tomb sweeping day in which families cleaned the graves of their ancestors. The train was traveling from the capital Taipei to the east coast city of Taitung. According to a government issued casualty list, the youngest person confirmed to have died was a 6-year-old girl, the oldest a 79-year-old man.
Reuters reporter Jason Albano. You're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Steve Miller. Egypt's Suez Canal Authority says that the last of the ships that were backed up following the clearing of the blocked container ship Ever Given on March 29th have now finished transitioning the waterway. Fresh ship traffic will now be allowed to go through the canal. Edward Uranian has the details.
Ships passing through Egypt's Suez Canal blow their horns as they make their way through the strategic waterway. The head of the Suez Canal Authority, Usama Rabia, told Egyptian media Friday that all shipping traffic that was backed up from the blockage of the waterway caused by the gigantic Ever Given container ship should clear the canal Saturday. He says that as of Friday, 350 of the 422 backed up ships will have cleared the Suez Canal, meaning that the remaining 75 or so will go through on Saturday and new ships can start to transit. The canal was reopened to shipping traffic after the Ever Given was refloated on March 29th. The investigation into the causes of the accident are still taking place, and Rabia told Arab media that the process should be finished within the next several days. The former head of the Suez Canal Authority, Mohamed Mamish, told Saudi-owned Al Arabiya TV that one freak accident, which probably will not occur again, is not likely to spur talk of widening the canal, which would be very expensive. Talk about finding an alternate shipping route, he adds, is not very practical. He says that there is no replacement for the Suez Canal. You can transit the canal in 12 hours under safe conditions, so just because there was one accident doesn't mean we need to go looking for a new shipping route. Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi told journalists this past week that the accident caused a media sensation which placed a great deal of pressure on Egypt. He says that any crisis that Egypt faces is difficult and has serious consequences for the well-being of our country. He notes that there was little talk about the canal for years until the recent accident, and then it suddenly became a main topic of world media. International shipping was severely disrupted by the almost 1 week blockage of the Suez Canal, causing some ships to take the long route around the Cape of Good Hope. Egypt estimates that it lost approximately $1 billion in transit fees and in salvage work to refloat the ship. Paul Sullivan, who is a professor at the Washington-based U.S. National Defense University, tells VOA that things got back to normal quicker than most thought possible, but the shipping industry and security services of the world need to prepare for the next problems in these very important global trade and international security choke points, such as the Strait of Hormuz, Malacca Straits, Panama Canal, and the Bosphorus. Egypt earns between $5 billion and $6 billion each year in revenues from the canal. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
The first week of the trial of Derek Chauvin, the white former police officer accused of murder and manslaughter, the death of George Floyd, an African-American man, featured graphic video and dramatic testimony of Floyd's arrest. International Edition's Chinedu Ofor spoke with former defense attorney Jack Rice.
I have to say that the prosecution has been doing a very good job this first week. They've focused on putting on a lot of eyewitnesses, those people who saw what they saw in the streets on the 25th of May in South Minneapolis. They put a lot of people on and they showed a lot of video. And that which didn't surprise me was that even during the opening statements themselves, the prosecutor in this case put on that 8-minute and 46-second video that really spread across the world. And I think that was designed to be a foundation for the rest of this trial. And I think it had a real impact upon the jury.
What about the defense? What do you think are the high points of their argument?
When we look at where the defense is right now, what they're really trying to argue, and they're going to be doing this not as much as effectively as they have this week, but probably next week and the week thereafter, is what they're trying to argue is that George Floyd had some serious heart conditions, which is true, and even the state has acknowledged those issues. He had serious opioid issues. That was also true. On the date of offense, he was actually chewing up methamphetamine and fentanyl in his system, which can actually cause death itself. And finally, also that George Floyd was actually fighting the police up until the point where he was put on the ground by those police officers. So really the argument, simply put, by the defense is that it wasn't Derek Chauvin that killed George Floyd. It was George Floyd's behavior and his pre-existing conditions that really made this happen. It's a tall order. It's going to be somewhat difficult for the defense, and they're in a very difficult place right now. But I think that seems to be what the arguments that they intend to make.
From your experience, is the defense shooting for an outright acquittal, or they're just trying to put in some doubts in the minds of the jury?
It's a great question. I think it's difficult for the defense in a case like this because of the amount of video and some of the really compelling statements being made here. I think we should also add that in the wake of George Floyd's death last May, there were really incredible riots in Minneapolis and St. Paul and some even around the country. And even around the world, there are more than 1,600 buildings that were burned here in these cities. And I think that is having an impact upon this jury as well. Nevertheless, what the defense is really working on right now is I think it's unlikely that they may get an acquittal, although they may be able to acquit on the most serious second-degree unintentional murder charge. But I think they're also looking for potentially something called a hung jury in the United States, which means that you're not going to get all of those jurors to agree, because in the U.S., you need a unanimous jury in order to convict here, and they're trying to get that in that third-degree murder charge and maybe even that manslaughter charge.
With the stakes so high and the trial resuming on Monday, what do you expect?
What we saw in the last 2 days of trial this week were people from the Minneapolis Police Department trying to establish what the standard of behavior is and should be for their police officers. And in fact, one of the things that they said that really stuck out to me from one of the detectives in this case is that the use of a technique where you put an officer puts their knee on the neck of somebody who's detained is, quote unquote, totally unnecessary. That's the standard that they're trying to make. They're going to continue to really work that point. I'm sure that the chief of the Minneapolis Police Department, Chief Arredondo, will testify on probably Monday or Tuesday at latest. And so I expect to see the prosecution continue down that path. They will then start to turn to other experts, including medical examiners, to look at autopsy reports. There's going to be a huge fight when it comes to that issue down the road. Plus, I expect the defense will also be contesting that question of behavior and the standards of conduct and just how much force was necessary based upon the circumstances in this case. So it's going to be a very busy week.
That was Jack Rice, a former defense attorney, speaking to my colleague, Chinedu Afor. There needs to be a balance between security and public access of the U.S. Capitol building, even in the wake of last week's deadly attack that killed an officer, says the lawmaker heading a bipartisan effort to investigate the January 6th riot. AP correspondent Julie Walker has more.
Republican Senator Roy Blunt says the Capitol is an important symbol of who we are. It must be secure but free.
I think the permanent fencing should come down. I don't think it does the job. In fact, the fencing was right there when the car drove through.
Officer William Evans was killed Friday when police say Noah Green ran his car into a barrier, then lunged with a knife. Green was shot and killed. Retired Lieutenant General Russell Honore, who led a review of security failures in the January attack, says the proposal to Congress includes more officers, updated screenings, and fencing that comes out of the ground as required. But it takes money.
Police in the Capitol deserve this. Our nation deserves it. And those families who've lost loved ones deserve it.
Their comments were made on ABC's This Week. I'm Julie Walker.
This is Science in a Minute.
On October 20th, 2020, NASA's OSIRIS-REx spacecraft briefly touched down on and dug about 48 centimeters into the asteroid Bennu to scoop up and store a little over 60 grams of rock and other surface material. The spacecraft is set to leave Bennu in May and will bring those samples back to Earth for analysis when it returns in September 2023. But on April 7th, before it leaves the asteroid, NASA says it will send the OSIRIS-REx on a final flyover, where it will get as close as 3.7 kilometers to its surface. According to the space agency, the so-called touch-and-go event in October seriously disturbed Bennu's surface. So scientists want to get a closer look at the damage the spacecraft caused as it gathered the samples. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Asians are a diverse group in the United States, but they all share a similar response to possible hate crimes. Activists spoke with VOA's Virginia Gunawan for this report.
Violent acts against Asian Americans have been on the rise across the United States. In cities like New York and Philadelphia, there have been hate crimes against Asian Americans. A local community leader in Philadelphia describes an incident against two Indonesian teens on the subway.
They push the girls sitting on the bench and say, like, keep, move, move, move. And the girls from the other group just smack the Indonesian teen on the side of her head and, like, repeatedly. And then after that, the other one got punched and smacked until, like, her headphones fell off.
So Philadelphia resident Simba Benyami Storms has long been active in anti-racism movements, from the Black Lives Matter movement of last summer to the Stop Asian Hate movement now.
There are just so many layers of hate in this country. I want us to peel them one by one and shed the light on them.
She says one thing that hampers investigation into possible hate crimes against Asian Americans is the reluctance to report incidents.
Typically, Asians are known to be that model minority. You know, in Indonesian, people probably will say, like, oh, you know what, like, just don't get involved. Because, you know, like, you maybe get hurt if you get involved. We don't speak up. We don't get the data. and we don't get the resources coming to our community, resources like funding, resources like security, just coming for the police.
Attacks against Asians are reportedly on the rise across the U.S., driven by rhetoric and misinformation blaming China for the coronavirus pandemic. The advocacy group Stop AAPI Hate cites almost 3,800 incidents ranging from racial slurs to physical attacks from March 2020 through February of this year. Data compiled by California State University's Center for the Study of Hate and Extremisms recorded 122 hate crimes in 2020, over twice the number in 2019. Activists say many factors could cause Asian Americans to underreport potential hate crimes.
They may not have had good interactions with the local police or the government in the past, and therefore do not trust that anything good's going to come out of it. And that's not an unfounded fear, right? Because of the stories about police misconduct, too, toward people of color in this country.
Indonesian Americans account for less than 1% of the estimated 22 million Americans of Asian descent. While most have been spared the recent spate of anti-Asian incidents, Indonesian consulates and the Indonesian embassy have issued an alert to be extra vigilant when out in the public. From Washington, D.C., Virginia Gunawan, VOA News.
Around the world, women have disproportionately suffered from the impact of the coronavirus pandemic, and women working in journalism are no different. Advocates say this imperils the rich and important tradition of storytelling. VOA's Anita Powell spoke to one African female journalist who is trying to get stories out despite the challenges.
Kim Wall was a fearless journalist. The 30-year-old freelancer had reported from some of the world's toughest places, from Haiti to Uganda to North Korea, and focused on unusual, rarely told stories. But the Swedish national was killed in 2017 on what seemed like a comparatively harmless assignment, interviewing the inventor of a homemade submarine, just kilometers from her childhood home. Voices like hers, big, bold, and female, now are coming under threat in media around the world. While this does not appear to be a concerted effort to suppress female journalists, it's a very real problem, and one that the pandemic is making worse, says Nadine Hoffman, deputy director of the International Women's Media Foundation. The foundation has documented a number of setbacks for female journalists around the world. One trend is particularly worrying. Online vitriol appears to be rising, especially as more people take their lives online.
We have seen an uptick in misogyny and in anti-women rhetoric in online spaces as our lives have basically migrated entirely to those online spaces, which makes sense. And especially in the U.S., for example, around last year's election, I think that the rhetoric about women journalists, and in particular the rhetoric that came from then President Trump towards women who were, for example, covering his administration, was completely reprehensible. And we are hopeful that we are entering now a new era where there will be respect, and that this online violence, we can stand up and say, this is not acceptable, and, you know, it has to stop.
One way the foundation is doing that is by assisting female journalists with financial help and grants, including from a fund in Wall's name that aids reporters whose work furthers her legacy. Zimbabwe-born video journalist Bongani Siziba received a grant from the Wall Fund. She spoke to VOA from her base in Johannesburg.
For me, I'm more interested in stories that hardly make it to the media mainstream, especially stories of girl child, human interest stories, and recently I grew to like cultural stories.
That's the focus of her grant project, a deep look at well-known South African artist Esther Mahlangu, whose intricate Ndebele paintings have dazzled the international art scene. These are stories that need to be told, Siziba says, because the 85-year-old artist's massive, colorful geometric works are just part of her work. She also runs a school for young female artists at her home in rural South Africa and teaches them how to navigate life in a society notorious for its high rates of violence against women. This story matters, Siziba says, but in these tough times, she can't sell it.
2 weeks after the lockdown started, I received a letter from one of the news agencies I was freelancing for. My contract was terminated, and I didn't know what to do. And weeks again after that, another contract was terminated, so which means I didn't have any source of income. So I had to rely on just going out there doing a story and not knowing who I will sell the story to. So it has been very hard, and we're still going on. I don't know how, but COVID-19 has totally changed everything, especially in the media space. For us women, it has been tough.
The pandemic-related economic duress is recent, but the barriers women face in journalism are age-old. Consider, say Hoffman and her colleague Charlotte Fox, the media's reaction to Wall's death, which was ruled a murder.
I mean, she got on a submarine to have an interview with a submarine builder, and people acted like she had done something completely inappropriate by, as a solo female reporter, going to meet her source.
And I was listening to a podcast by some vulture writers on the investigation, and all they could talk about was their disbelief, and they were actually laughing that a woman would get on a submarine to interview this guy, and she shouldn't have done that, and all of this would be prevented.
But these are the facts. It is not Kim Wall's fault she was killed. The woman was just doing her job. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
The coronavirus pandemic has increased hunger and food insecurity in Zimbabwe, which was already struggling with a poor economy before the pandemic began. The World Health Program says the problem is essentially acute for unemployed urban dwellers, and Columbus Muvhunga reports.
The government report called the Zimbabwe Vulnerability Assessment says about 2.4 million people in the country's urban areas are struggling to meet their basic food needs because of lockdowns to contain the spread of COVID-19. 61-year-old Murambiwa Simon Mushongorokwa used to get casual jobs in the factories before the lockdowns began.
The lockdown is a tight.
He says, I used to get about $30 a week. It was not enough for my needs. But when the lockdown came, it got worse until I started growing mushroom. It's slowly improving my life. If the market prices improve, we'll survive, says Mushongorokwa. He uses forage from his backyard corn and sorghum field to grow the mushrooms. He says he now gets about $5 a week from selling it and uses some for consumption with his wife and five dependents. Simon Julius Kufakwevanu, an official from a local NGO, has been teaching people in this poor suburb to grow mushrooms.
Before the introduction of mushroom farming in this area, it was very tough for people in this community to survive because of the lockdown and so forth. But now, when fish of all brought in the mushroom growing, it's changing because you can now buy something. You are now able to go to the shops and buy mealy meal, buy sugar and so forth. Even if I can get ill, I can go to the hospital because of after selling mushroom.
The World Food Program says it is looking for more ideas and resources to help 550,000 people like Mushongorokwa in urban areas get basic food for survival. Thompson Piri, head of communications at World Food Program, speaking from his base, Geneva.
COVID-19 has not only wiped lives, it has wiped livelihoods as well. The number of people who are unable to put food on their table in Zimbabwe's urban areas has increased from 30% during the same period in 2019 to 42% right now. The World Food Program is scaling up its assistance to reach 550,000 people who are living in urban areas.
Zimbabwe government says it is giving about $12 a month to families affected by lockdowns. That's nowhere near the $500 an average family of 5 to 7 people needs to survive each month. People like Mushongorokwa hope that with the lockdowns recently eased, jobs and livelihoods will come back. In the meantime, the WFP is seeking $32 million to feed food insecure urbanites. Columbus Mavungam for VOA News, Harare, Zimbabwe.
And this has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.